Oh my gosh, you guys, you know, I'll tell you, Noah, I had to have a talk with myself after your ThinkPad review and last. That was a legitimately tempting review. Like after the things that the main things that really sold me was the problem-free built-in LTE modem and temporary battery. So you could swap batteries. I'm big on that. I'm big on battery swap, and I was king of battery. One of my favorite laptops of all time was the Apple Pismo, and it was like when Steve Jobs was gone, and every bay was modular and compatible with each other. So DVD bays could also be battery bays. So you could have two batteries or two DVDs or a hard drive and a battery. And I love that, man, because I get 8-9 hours of battery life out of
that
thing.
I don't want to make you I don't want to make you too jealous. But Chris, do you know what my latest thing is on the ThinkPad?
What?
Have you heard of the battery slice?
The what?
So the battery slice is a battery, literally the footprint of the laptop itself.
Oh,
so
and it goes underneath it, kind of, right?
And it goes underneath, and
that's not even new. That's been around for a little bit, actually, because I used to have one.
I've not had one before, and I had a 10-hour flight to Tokyo. I had a 5-hour flight to Seattle. I had a 1-hour flight to Minneapolis. I had 2 hours in the airport there. I had 2 hours in the airport in Tokyo, and I had my laptop powered on pretty much the whole time. Yeah. It went almost 24 hours
straight. So this actually goes like in the docking port, right?
Yes. The battery slice attaches to the
docking port. So you have your extended battery plus you now have this battery, which goes in your docking port.
Right. It's crazy.
Yeah, they've had that for a while. That's super cool. I used to have one with that for a little bit.
The batteries because of that power dock or the power center at the front.
Yeah. Too bad I really, really, really don't like Lenovo as a company.
This is Linux Unplugged, episode 151 for June 28th, 2016.
Welcome to Linux Unplugged, your weekly Linux talk show that's ready to go on vacation and is trusting the post-production process. My name is Chris.
My name is Noah.
Hello there, Noah. Thank you for joining me this week. You're actually back. You made it back from Tokyo.
It wasn't without event.
Well, I'm glad you could make it because we have a great show today. Coming up, Linux Mint 18 is just hitting the interwebs. I'll give you my quick take on that. I've got it installed on a machine. And I kick the tires. And then later on, is desktop Linux almost dead? I don't mean actually like Linux on the desktop. I mean desktop computers in general. Now with these massive machines that are desktop replacements, devices like the NUC and, of course, the penetration of mobile, you got to wonder, is there really a role for the truck anymore? At least let's zoom out like 10 years and talk about the future of Linux on the desktop, especially in light of some recent new hardware releases. Plus, we've got great updates from the Red Hat Summit, from the Docker group. There could be a new Ubuntu phone in development. What? And much, much more. So, Noah, I am super looking forward to Linux Unplugged 151 because 152 will not contain any Chris. So this is my last episode before I go on vacation. You'll sit down in the center seat at the helm and command the ship. I can't even believe you're here. I can't even believe you're here because I figured you're coming back from Tokyo. You're a busy guy. You got lots of stuff to cover. A lot of things to catch up on.
11:59 at night when there's no flights to Grand Forks.
So you ended up spending a good amount of time in Seattle, it sounds like.
I ended up spending from 8 in the morning until like 6:50 in the Seattle airport. And I was to the point where I thought I was going to inadvertently be doing Linux Unplugged in studio. And then I made a last-ditch effort flight and got back to Minneapolis at midnight and then rented a car and drove for 4.5 hours back to Grand Forks.
Oh, no.
I had a client that I had to take care of this morning. And so I was expecting to be back on Saturday and that didn't work out. And then I was hoping to get back on Sunday and that didn't work out. And so ended up being Monday, very, very, very late.
Man, it's always down to the wire, isn't it? Isn't it funny how that happens?
I work much better that way.
It's true. That's true. I have this, you know, my road trip. I'm going to Montana. I'm going to do some soaking. I'm bringing Dylan with me. It's his first road trip. He's 7 years old. You know, it's summer break between first grade and second grade for him. So this is like a big deal trip. This is like the stakes are high. This is his first impression to road trip. So we're really trying to make sure we just stock it full of fun stuff for him to do. So we're going to stop along the way. We're going to do like the Lewis and Clark Caverns. We're going to go to water parks. And we basically have activities planned every single day. But as of right now, I still don't even have Lady Jupes back in my possession.
Jeez, man.
I know. I am. Yeah. It is down to the wire, Noah.
You are. You're cutting it down to the wire. I'm really glad that you've given yourself, well, that the circumstances have turned out so that you have so much leeway when something goes wrong.
So here's what I've learned. It's like owning a boat, I think. Owning an RV is like owning a boat where every time you kind of take it out on a major voyage, stuff breaks. And that's why you own RVs that have warranties that cover everything. And to their credit, everything has been covered for totally, absolutely for free. The only problem is the delay as you authorize parts and you wait for that and that kind of thing. So
right.
I don't even think this road trip is going to be possible except for we've gotten great customer service by one individual. I'm going to give him a shout out right here to Jeff. He's down at Sunset RV. Now, they have a main Fife location where we bought our rig, but at a Buckley is where their maintenance divisions run. And Jeff, like, he's been calling up Thor and verifying, are you authorizing this? Where's this at? Can you put rush shipping on these parts? And then he's going to drive it up to our campsite as soon as it's ready to go, so that way we can start loading it up and pack it up so we don't have to do that whole drive my truck down there, jump in the rig and hit the road thing. We can actually pack it up at our regular site. So he's going to drive it up there when as soon as they get done working on it, either that's Thursday night, Friday night, something like that. And I told him if he can bring it up there, I'll take him out for a beer.
Because
I leave Saturday morning. I leave Saturday morning,
yeah,
so it's like tight.
Yeah.
Oh. And then at some point, you'll be hearing a lot more from Noah because he'll be sitting in the seat right here. So let's jump into some of the stories we have to get into this week. We got a lot of project updates, a lot. And so without going too far, without getting to them, I think we should probably bring in our virtual lug. Time-appropriate greetings, Mumble Room.
Hey, Pip.
Time-appropriate greetings.
Hey-o.
Hello, everybody. Hello. Well, hello. Hi there. You know, I wanted to talk about something right at the top of the show because Mr. Drum, Edrum, or perhaps you might know him as Sean, in the Mumble Room has worked on
something. Sometimes Edrum.
Yeah, well, no. he worked on something special for me as a gift for Lass's 10th birthday. And it was a nice, totally set up – we'll talk more about why it's super, super cool set up installation of Mattermost for the Jupyter Broadcasting community. Now, we've talked about Mattermost in the past. That's that open source alternative to Slack. So is Rocket Chat. That's another one. And this week – I wanted to highlight an article over at opensource.com because I really ragged on them last week. So I thought it'd only be fair to highlight when they do something pretty cool to actually give them some credit. So I don't know if you had a chance to listen to last week's episode, but I kind of called them out for a few things. And this week, though, I thought they had a great post up here by Adam Hyde on open source software needing to sell the user experience. And I think a lot of us that listen to the show or participate in our virtual lug agree that user experience is a super important part of the end result. And he talks about how Mattermost is doing open source the right way, about how they're creating a compelling project, something that definitely competes with Slack, takes advantage of its open source heritage, uses that to build into features, have things like code highlighting and snippets that are way better than anything Slack can do, while also providing a great interface. And so it was sort of, I thought, a great opportunity with this article just posted, full link in the show notes if you guys want to read it. Maybe we talk to Sean and get his sort of back-end take on Mattermost, what it was like to set it up for something that could potentially be used at large scale, and just sort of his overall thoughts on it. So, Sean, first of all, thanks for the 10th anniversary gift of setting up Mattermost. We had a cool opportunity to use it during our Fedora review. We had a back-channel thread going during last. Worked out super well. I kind of just want to hear your thoughts on setting up Mattermost for a production deployment and what you think of it as a software technology.
Yeah, it's really, I think it really runs really well. During the Fedora review, everyone was on there, the load on the server, CPU load was like 0.05.
Yeah, it was, it seemed like it was
and
working
RAM
great.
Was like 200 megabytes, and it just purrs like a kitten. Setup wise, back when, you did the Mattermost and Rocket Chat review, is when I started working on this, and I actually created a script for DigitalOcean to put in the user data field, and so you just paste that in there, set the variables for your configuration, and let it rip. And
nice.
It goes through and it takes care of setting up the firewall, setting up your admin user. It generates all new salts, all passwords, sets up the whole stack. And it also does sets up Let's Encrypt. So if you already have your A record,
cool,
you can just set that up right during the install. If not, there are two admin scripts in the admin user's home directory. And at that point, you can just run. One will install a self-signed cert, and the other one will set up Let's Encrypt.
Hmm.
And it'll also create a cron job, so auto-renew.
So what would you say once all this is set up? Sorry, then you can go. I just wanted to know, for people that are listening right now that maybe have an open source project they're involved in, total commit time to getting Mattermost at a decent Mattermost installation at that setup, total commit time, what would you say it is?
If you use my script, 3 to 5 minutes.
Can you link that to me in the IRC so I can put in the show notes and then go ahead, Noah?
Yeah, and to be clear, when he says a script, he doesn't mean like you have to set DigitalOcean up and then log into the droplet and then run a script. That's not what he's talking about. He actually custom designed the script so that it can be dropped in in the DigitalOcean control panel and then spun up.
That is awesome.
And I wasn't even aware of that feature of DigitalOcean. And during Linux Fest Northwest, like 2 months ago, we were in the hotel lobby at like 3. Why is it that the meeting time in the hotel lobby is like 3 in the morning?
Well, it's because it's either you're there to pick up hookers or you're talking about Linux. That's
That's true. Well, there were no hookers in Blow that night. So we were working on our laptops, and he was showing me how he could literally drop this script in. You change like, what, Sean, 7 variables, and then you click on the button.
There's three variables that you need to change. But there's like 30 other variables you can change if you want to really set it up and not have to do any configuration, or if you want to keep the configuration that you already have and set it up on a second droplet as like a failover, or if you want to test something, you can use the same configuration for both.
You know, here's why, Sean, I think this is kind of an important thing, and I actually wouldn't mind just sort of double downing. That sounds like a sandwich on this, because one of the reasons why Jupiter Broadcasting accidentally started using Slack was because it took me 35 seconds to try it. And then I was like, oh, well, we could actually use this. And so this is basically the way the decision tree works for me is this going to be a critical piece of technology to the successful operation of my business? If it is, I would like to own it, control it, deploy it. However, if owning, controlling, and deploy it takes way more time than I have to dedicate to it, then I will never do it. I will never get it done. So then I might as well just go use the hosted solution that seems to be from a reputable company that's going to be around for a while, because at least then I'm using something versus not using anything at all. So by creating a script that makes it super fast and easy to deploy Mattermost, you're making it much more competitive, I think, with Slack.
Sean, what was the first thing I told you when you first telegrammed me and said, why aren't you guys using Mattermost?
Hello? Chris would have to set it up.
And what did I say Chris's decision is based off of?
Path of least resistance.
Damn it, you make me sound like a bastard, Noah. It's not like...
No. I just make you sound like a person who has a lot of really important things to do. And so delving into to the specifics of setting up a server on a relatively new software platform is not really something you have the time or energy to tackle.
Well,
but if somebody else did it, you'd be willing to use it.
Especially when you're not sure how much value it's actually going to return to you. So, you know, you're not really willing to commit half a day to something if it's maybe something nobody uses.
Right.
Because who would think that setting up something that's basically IRC would actually be useful? Why not just use IRC? I mean, that was my default thinking about it. And that was my essential bias that I had, my old man bias coming in until I actually tried it. So I don't know, Mr. Drum, anything else you want to touch on Mattermost before we move on? I don't think so then.
They're working on a federated system so you can have multiple Mattermost connect to each other.
That's cool. That will be very nice. That will be very, very nice. That's always something I'm a big fan of. Speaking of fans, I there is something going on over at System 76. They have it's only going on for a little bit too, but they're lowering prices with retweets of tweets of the hashtag Ubuntu76 for 2 days, up to $350 off. And I'm not saying I have inside knowledge. I'm just saying I have inside knowledge. That's all I'm saying. And you have a little inside knowledge too, Noah. There is something in the works here. I'm just saying it's in your benefit to get in on this. Just put that out there. So if you check them out, twitter.com/system76, they're tweeting about it right now. The key is to tweet with hashtag Ubuntu76. And there's something they've been working for quite a while on really hard, and they're super, super excited about it. I've been getting telegrams. I mean, I shouldn't say this. Unidentified sources have been informing me about what could be in the works, and I'm just saying I'm pretty excited about it. So I've been retweeting, and you guys should too, because it'll be worth it. All right. Speaking of what might be worth it, this might be worth buying. This could be my next and finally, I might add, the first Ubuntu phone I buy. It's called Midori. And no, it's not a GTK web browser based on WebKit that you wish you could use but just doesn't have enough features. It could be the next Ubuntu phone. That's at least according from reader Richard S. over at OMG Ubuntu, who pointed OMG Ubuntu to bug 1551811. Obviously, I know what you're all thinking. It's right there in the name. This obviously points to a new Ubuntu phone. Actually, the bug mentions a device code named Midori with regards to a trust prompt issue that causes a reboot on the MX4 and a mystery new handset. Later on in the bug report, director of engineering over at Canonical says this will block Midori RC. Of course, RC being the release candidate channel for Ubuntu Touch Images. A quick googling around shows that Midori would be in keeping with the code names for previous Ubuntu devices, because they're based, for some reason, on Dragon Ball franchise references. So you have a couple other bits of evidence, too. There is some discussion in IRC channel about working on a fairly large change. Interesting. Poppy, could you define the term OFONO for me? What is that? What is OFONO?
OFONO. It's the radio stack that we use for doing... it's part of the radio stack. You know, think of it like network manager and all that kind of stuff.
So they're working on a fairly large OFONO change at the moment for a new handset, it says in IRC. And we're expecting to land a new version of OFONO soon. Ooh, what could it be? A new device is expected all of a sudden. Codename Midori. Noah, I think where there is fire and there is smoke, there is an Ubuntu phone. What do you think?
I think you might be onto something. Every time I see the Ubuntu phone in person, I tell myself, I'm like, this is perfect. I want this.
Did you get a little?
I did. Well, so Michael Hall, that's his exclusive phone, right? So that we took him. So Canonical shipped them a computer for their demo, but they may or may not have forgotten the Euro cord that goes in the back of it.
Euro cord, dude, really?
Yeah, sorry, power cord. So they we had to go to a store to go get a power cord, I was in the car and I was talking with him and I was like, man, you really use that all the time? And he's like, yeah, it's a great experience.
Let's be clear. You're like, no, you're in the car with Michael Hall driving to an electronics store and you're like, holy crap. You're not shitting me. You actually use Ubuntu Touch. That's your reaction. You actually are using that thing. You didn't pull out an Android device when we go to find an electronics store. That was your reaction.
So I just have a problem, and I think you're in the same boat, of like using the same using a phone that doesn't have the available apps
Waze.
Every other platform does, and they have the necessary ones, right? They have like a terminal and an email client and Telegram and stuff like Telegram. But there's a couple things that are missing, and so I guess I was a little surprised that that was his exclusive phone. But it seems, with a couple of exceptions, seems to work very, very well.
Wait, are you saying that there wasn't a Maps program on the phone?
There was. Yeah, he does. So he doesn't have GPS. So I was doing the navigation.
Oh, the phone doesn't have GPS.
Well, I think the phone does.
It does. He happened to have a broken one.
That's a bit of a bummer.
So in any case, so there's like little pitfalls. The thing though, when I get back though, is I just have such a hard time to actually make the leap. Like when I'm sitting here and I'm using my S6, and I'm not a huge Android fan. Like I don't particularly like Android. I just don't know that I dislike it enough to go to a completely different. A completely different system. And I was looking through, like even small things, like, we switched over to OS Ticket for AltaSpeed now. I'm not going to have an app for that. And I use that daily, to update work orders and get push notifications when new ones come in and all that.
Daredevin, where do you fall down on this particular issue?
For me, I think it will happen, the transition, the same way transition happened for me in Windows. Like
from
when I was
Windows?
Using Windows.
Yeah.
When I transitioned from Windows to full-time Linux, I was like this decision of like, I'm not going to care. I'm just going to deal with the circumstances that show up as they show up because I believe in it. So I want to see where it goes and be supportive of
that. Well, that's usually Noah's line.
I did that, and I don't regret it. And in the phone, I think it will happen that I've been saying that I'd like a convergence thing, but, you know, I think when I do the jump, it will be something like that. I just drop my phone and say, whatever. If it's not there, I'll work on getting it there.
You know what I think I need? I guess what I need is I need a me in the mobile space. I need somebody to come along, walk alongside me, and solve my problems so that I'm not – so and hold my hand so I'm not scared. That's what I need.
Poppy, how realistic would it be for someone like me to assume that this might be an image for a device that already exists versus a brand new device?
So this was reported on OMG Ubuntu, and I think there was a photo of the device as well. There's been a couple of photos leaked.
I've seen a couple myself, yeah.
One of them was a bit pixelated, and the other one I think is a bit clearer. But
they show the convergence in full effect, and they show it docked to, like, in one case, it shows it docked in there, and you see the Unity 8 session up on the screen.
But when you mention the image, it's pretty much the same image on every device. So when, you know, some new feature is enabled, it's enabled for everyone, unless it's like hardware specific, like a fingerprint reader or something. Then it, you know, everyone gets it. So if there's new software which fixes bugs in Network Manager or something that fixes bugs in the radio or GPS, then everyone gets the fixes on all the devices.
Do you own a PlayStation 4, Poppy?
No, I'm a PC gamer, PC master race. Sorry.
I just wonder because I just saw this leaked photo with the PS4 and I just wonder where it came from. Because, you know.
Yeah, I think that's you know, when you're compiling stuff, you like turn to the screen next to you and start
playing
games.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to
stuff.
Go. I find it to be exciting that there's a possibility that there's a new device already, because I feel like we just got the Pro, the Muez or whatever you say it, Pro, which was a brand new, which seemed like a really nice high-end phone.
Meizu,
thank you. Yep. And so here we are. It feels like Mobile World Congress was just a couple of weeks ago, and we already are hearing possibly rumors about a new phone. Plus, last week we talked about the OnePlus 3 getting a community around it to get Ubuntu Touch running on that, which is an extremely well-reviewed phone. So perhaps it is finally happening, as the Ron Paul meme says. Speaking of mobile, let's talk about Ting. That's right. Go to linux.ting.com and learn more about Ting. Ting is a mobile service provider, my mobile service provider, Noah's mobile service provider. It's just mobile that makes sense. It's only pay for what you use mobile with no contract. $6 for the phone line, and then just your usage on top of that. It's super straightforward, super crazy simple. No gimmicks, no like on Tuesdays you're going to get this, and over the weekends you can do this, and if you don't use this, we'll roll into this, but only for this amount of time. Like, it's ridiculous. Or you want to do hotspot or tethering, you have to call in and enable that. Like, that kind of stuff is the 90s. It's done. It's over with. And what's nice about Ting is they have two networks to pick from, CDMA and GSM, and all the devices are unlocked. So if you're like crazy Noah and you're traveling to Tokyo, you can take your everyday driver phone and just pop a new SIM in there. It's no big deal. Or like sometimes, you know, like Needles, Noah and I will swap phones because we're not hardcore junkies. We're hardcore phone nerds. And we swap phones and it's just pop the SIM in, pop the SIM out. It's true. Like and legitimately, when Noah travels to the JB1 studios, he usually brings a Ting SIM with him. True or not, Noah?
Yeah, I travel everywhere with one. And I made this guide actually. I'll have to get it to you. I stole it from the Ting website, but I went through and I started identifying different like ideal phone specifications and which models.
Oh, nice.
Specific which models you can buy, so that when people ask, they say, "Oh, I want the XYZ." I can say, "Well, this is the specific model for that phone that you want."
Right.
That would work with Ting or whatever. And that's been really neat, because if you buy one that has all of the I think there are 5 bands that you're looking for LTE. If you buy one of those phones with all 5 bands, it will work not only on Ting, but again, if you're roaming abroad into Europe or in Japan. So I just, you know, and you can buy a prepaid SIM in almost any country, stick it in, and then you have a local number. You act like a local.
Yeah. And you know, it's getting way more common to have all of the bands just built into the phones, especially the most recent phones. That's just sort of what the chipset brings now. So that's making it easier. But so Ting has a CDMA and GSM network. And so like with the Nexus devices, you could have either or. It depends on your phone and what its capabilities are. But if you understand that there's a thing called GSM and there's a thing called CDMA, you're pretty much good to go. Ting is going to really help you out. They have great customer service, so you get to speak to a human being. They have a dashboard that makes managing all of this crazy easy. They have a store online where you can get things from feature phones that start at like $60-$50. Just, I mean, imagine that. You need a backup line where you can just make phone calls and you only pay for when you use it, get a $50 feature phone and put it, you know, just put it on Ting. Or go all the way up and get yourself a full-fledged computing device that's unlocked and you own it outright. I personally, as much as I can, I am advocating for the Nexus Ting combo or iPhone Ting combo. I think having been back on Android for a few weeks now since Linux Fest and sort of now getting appreciation for those monthly updates from Google, it makes Android to me a much more palatable, much more secure, much more like feels much more in line with my priorities from a really important computing device, you know, something that's getting security updates directly from the vendor. And Ting never gets in the way of that process. They don't have an agenda. They don't have to like brand the update before it gets out there. So when you get a Nexus device from the Play Store and you bring it over to Ting, a couple of really amazing things happen. First of all, when you go to linux.ting.com, your first month is going to probably be paid for because average Ting bill is like $23-24 for a line. So you go to linux.ting.com, you get your first month paid for. You bring the device on there. You pick GSM or CDMA, whatever's stronger in your area because the Nexus devices are doing all of it. Once you get it online, put it on Wi-Fi, get all your updates, get all your applications installed, and then just sit back and enjoy the savings. It's such a great combination. Even if you're from outside the U.S. and you're just visiting the States for a little while, go on eBay, get a cheap GSM phone. Put it on the Ting network, and that can be your travel account.
No, if they're traveling from the outside the U.S., lot of phones abroad have two SIM slots.
Yeah, I know. Just bring a phone. And it's so simple because at the end of the day, you have the safety net of the Ting support where they're actual geeks that love this stuff and they're willing to engage with you. So you actually have really great support to go to. Check them out at linux.ting.com. Also, if you want to just support the show by visiting that page, go read their blog. They got a new post on 130 over-the-air TV stations coming to us cord cutters. I have not had a chance yet to read this, but man, does that sound like music to my ears. As someone who's probably not going to be getting cable, and it may be satellite during the election if things get crazy, but I just, for right now, I'm trying to do everything over the air in Lady Jupes. And that's a blog post I'm going to read. So go to linux.ting.com. Hey, Noah, how about we get super geeky for a second on the show? You ready for this?
Oh, that's great. I love getting super geeky on the air.
I know you like yourself a VPN and that secure networking. So this is what I am looking forward to. It hasn't hit mainline kernel yet, but say goodbye soon to OpenVPN. Say goodbye to IPsec and say hello to the next generation secure network tunnel announced for Linux. Jason Donfield is the developer, and it's called WireGuard. It's described as a next-generation secure network tunnel for the Linux kernel. It's built into kernel space, unlike OpenVPN, which runs in user space. And inherently, when you're dealing with all this crypto stuff and networking stuff, we're running in user space and then communicating with the kernel. There's just an inherent disadvantage there. So Dunfield explained to a briefing to Pharonix last week about WireGuard. He says, IPsec is overly complex and impossible to actually use in a secure manner, but it's the fastest thing out there for a VPN and secure tunneling. OpenVPN, very popular, but it's super slow. And by virtue of being in user space, it contains a whole buggy SSL X509 stack. He says, I've started from scratch and written an extremely simple yet powerful cryptographically secure replacement in around 4,000 lines of code called WireGuard. It's much simpler than anything before it, with peers exchanging short curve 25519 public keys, just like in SSH. Secure network interfaces can be added and removed using the usual IP link and IP address tools. And from there, everything is easily taken care of by the kernel, and secure tunnels are made quite simple. Not only that, but the performance is in fact better than IPsec, which is basically a huge accomplishment. Now, this isn't brand new. He's been working on this for a while. It's been detailed at some kernel conferences, so it's not like it just showed up out of nowhere. It's using industry standard cryptographic standards, and they have a brand new website at wireguard.io, which they say there it aims to be an easy to configure and deploy as SSH is, but gives you a VPN connection made simply by exchanging very simple public keys, just like exchanging SSH keys. And all of it's transparently handled by WireGuard. Roaming between IP addresses, just like Mosh, is also supported. There's no need to manage connections, be concerned about state, manage daemons, or worry about what's under the hood. Very basic but powerful interface. This is a whole new way for doing secure networking under Linux. It's not a mainline kernel yet, but man, does this look super promising. Noah, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts about kind of just sort of wiping the slate clean and starting over with VPN technologies under Linux.
So anyone who has worked, especially in the commercial side of VPN, knows what a pain it is to get some of this stuff set up correctly. But part of me says that, like, the last one I did, which is just a couple of months ago, it was literally as simple as I logged, because the routers are supporting it now. I logged into the router. I checked a box. I specified the DHCP leaf space that I wanted the VPN clients to log in with. I created credentials and I was done. And that is thanks to the fact that OpenVPN is just like natively supported on like every major, you know, device now. So on some level, I feel like we have already gotten, you know, a long ways, and we've made a lot of headway and things are actually pretty good now. Though I do respect and understand the concept of, you know, it may not be as secure as it could be. And I got to tell you, Chris, having fought with VPN for almost 10 years in various different forms, if we could get to a point where it was as simple as SSH, where I could install one package on the destination, you know, server side, yeah, and one package on the client side, man, that's appealing.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And, you know, I start picturing like, just essentially using these types of links and connections as standard by default. There is one major issue the internet is taking with this new technology, and I wonder if anyone in the mumble room feels this way. One of the big pushbacks coming in right now, well, there's two, but the big first one I want to talk about is, what about putting something that is network accessible, that is essentially a core networking technology like this, in kernel space? Because if there is an exploit against this thing, you've just owned the entire kernel. You're now running, your exploit now runs with kernel level privileges. You're in.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't anybody in the mumble room have any concerns about this? I thought for sure somebody would. I thought for sure somebody would. Because that is genuinely, I think, a legitimate concern. The other, I think, number two issue, and the OpenVPN developers have already raised this one, is why not just spend this time making OpenVPN faster? Why can't we take all this energy you guys have and put it in OpenVPN? What do you think about that, Noah?
Yeah, I think that the thing about starting over, right, is it, I think to some degree it suffers from the not invented here syndrome. I think it's you know, you get these people that say, well, I could do this better, I could restart from scratch. And I think that then you essentially were reinventing the wheel on some level. On the other hand, though, every time I've seen this happen in the past where you take a technology, like look at systemd, for example, and I know it's probably a sore subject to bring up, but you look at systemd and look at what has happened, and we have taken something and completely redone it from scratch, and everyone kind of said the same thing, is, oh, you're reinventing the wheel, there's no reason to do this. And I got to tell you, we have gone from, you know, minutes of boot time to seconds. And if you're not working in a field where you see that, then maybe it's not as clear to you. But to me, there should be no discussion about this. It's a clear win. Might have been a little quick on the draw, but it is definitely the direction we should be moving. And so if a new VPN, you know, protocol system integrated at the kernel level, if we have that same kind of success and that same kind of cleanliness and that same kind of, you know, increase in performance and security, I'm all for it.
Okay. Well, here's his arguments. He says, you know, you just can't get the performance in userland applications. It's not that we don't want to support OpenVPN. It's that OpenVPN from a performance standpoint is just sort of doomed. And he said, the developer, the other thing about WireGuard is, this is why it's 4,000 lines of code. It's insanely simple. It's meant to be the smallest attack surface as possible. I was on the fence about this until I read Greg KH's post on Google+. Now, he's not a networking developer. Right? He focuses on the Linux kernel. He focuses on the LTS branch and on the USB stack and lots of important subsystems. The networking subsystem, not one of them. But he writes, a new VPN protocol and implementation for Linux. It was announced last year at the Kernel Recipes in Paris. It's great to see a releasable state at this point. I recommend taking a look at it if you're into this type of stuff. Disclosure, I have reviewed various versions of the kernel code over the past few months, and it seems sane. But he says, no, I'm not a kernel networking developer. So Greg says, you know what? It looks like good, sane kernel code to me, which is pretty encouraging. I mean, I definitely can't disagree with his opinion on the topic. So
I just have one thing. It's a network thing. It's about doing these type of – it's in the kernel level when we have to understand what it actually means. Being the kernel level also means that a potential flaw on it is 10 times higher the danger.
it's an immediate serious issue. It's an if it's especially if it's remotely exploitable.
Exactly, exactly. And not only that, it's also something that if it's buggy for some reason, crashes your entire system too, because it's in the kernel.
Yeah, yep, yep.
So those things should be in mind. Yes, you're not going to get the performance in the user space, but I think it's a good trade-off, maybe the performance for the security layer.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. I think I pretty much agree with your assessment. Okay. All right, well...
This is CNN Breaking News.
We have great news today on the Unplugged program. Finally, after years of waiting, Linux users, our prayers have been answered. Universal application installation is now available thanks to a brand new standard called Subuser. That's right, offering portability, security, and maintainability for user application installations on Linux. We have ourselves a brand new standard called Subuser. You got your flat packs? Go screw yourself. You got app images? Good for you. You got snaps? You got... I don't care! Because now we got Subusers. Are you excited, Noah? Come on! Subuser, buddy.
Yeah.
Oh!
So you know that XKCD comic problem? We have 13 community stand.
Yeah.
Comes to mind.
Special news correspondent Wes is joining us in the field right now for reporting on this. Wes, you are at the launch event for Subuser, correct?
Yes, I am.
And this is truly the one universal installation solution for all Linux users, correct, Wes? Is that what you're learning on the scene?
Well, I think Docker was there already, and this just makes Docker every place else.
That's right. That's because this is application installation with Docker. So you take your Docker containers, and now you use them to distribute all your applications with Subuser. That is, you like your, you know what? And here's the crazy thing. This almost could work because there is just a lot of stink behind Docker containers. There's a Docker container for everything. It's unbelievable. So if you take that and you whittle it down a little bit and you make it as an application delivery platform, you are utilizing the built-in knowledge set of all of these people that have already composed Docker containers, which is a lot. And it could almost by default just be a way people end up distributing applications. At what point, though, at what point do we just stop? I don't know. Like, I just don't know what to do with this anymore. It's too much. It's too much. My head kind of explodes. But there you go. It's Subuser, and you can read more about it. It's Docker and Python and a little bit of Git combined with a little bit of Docker.
I think, and to complement this, we need to have some universal window managers.
Yes, right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Got to make sure we get a couple of those, though. Can't just have one. Yeah.
You know, it's amazing how on one side of this argument I started out like 2 years ago. If you'd asked me 2 years ago what I thought about universal installers, I would have told you that it was the number one problem on Linux. And I don't care what anyone said, the number one resistance I think that happens to Linux, the reason that people don't port software to Linux, the number one reason is there is no universal, you know, app installer. Got to figure out which distro and navigate that whole mess. And now, like, I've almost gone to the complete other side of it because I'm not as convinced today that a universal installer could ever work in the Linux ecosystem. I don't know if I believe anymore that it's a viable solution for the very nature of Linux.
Oh, girl, you crazy. I almost don't know how, and I know I get so much crap for this, but I almost don't know how you can't see it. It's such, like, out of all of, I'd say it's the number one problem with Linux desktop.
I agree, but I don't think it's a solvable problem unless we all agree on one distro to use.
I disagree.
Well, the whole point of the of snaps, for example, is to be on multiple distros, so it doesn't matter what distro you use as long as the top-level application layer is not directly intertwined into the distro.
But then don't you have a handicapped version of the application, potentially?
No. What do you mean?
Well, so for example, if the Arch system, for example, works, you know, is not capable or works differently than Ubuntu, then isn't the snap package packaged for the lowest common denominator?
No, it would all work the same. It's just that the current reason the Arch thing doesn't work as well as the Ubuntu one is because the Ubuntu one has been out for 2 months and has been developed for 4 months, and the Arch one has been out for about four days.
So I'll tell you what I think. Here's what Kernel Linux is talking about, Rotten, is he's saying the application itself sort of has to assume the lowest common denominator when it comes into libraries. So for example, when I installed the VLC snap on Fedora 24, I got a version of VLC that had really, really crappy fonts compared to the rest of the Fedora 24 desktop, which this is one of the areas they specifically worked on for this release. And so it seemed like that's probably an early problem that's going to get worked out. But right now, that VLC snap doesn't take advantage of the better fonts and better font rendering on my host system. That seems like a bit of a downside, don't you think?
Well, yeah, it'd be kind of annoying. But if there was no one at all putting effort into like a shared library system for snaps, that would suck. But they're doing that, so I'm okay with it.
I think it's definitely less annoying than not having the application at all.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And the other thing,
they could just include the font they want.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
I wonder about user experience, like where app image to me feels like it's kind of the easiest from the like Windows user download and run it. I wonder how much we'll see that pushed. I think Canonical could do it, but it doesn't seem like it's at quite the same level yet. And that will probably determine a lot for the desktop user.
App image is not even that simple for the users. It's more simple than an EXE or a DMG in general, because you have to be able to do permissions. But as a user of app image, you have to know that you have to do that. So you have to give them information about that. You have to set your permissions so that it can execute. You also have to know how to do that in the first place. So there is still stepping stone that you have to go through for app images that doesn't make it the best. Whereas in certain cases, the goal for snaps is to have just an installer that you would go to the Ubuntu software app, or whatever they're calling it now, and then you just install it and there you have it, and it's a snap and you're done.
Wimby, I know
true,
you wanted
you
to try
to train people to go to that app. That's the thing.
That is actually
you could go to the website and download the snap and it work the same way.
Or if the website could somehow initiate the software center's page, that would be nice too.
An apt colon.
Yeah, totally. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Thing.
Wimby, I think you were about to try to jump in there during the crosstalk. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say on the point of that VLC application, or rather snap, because I've not seen it, but I understand what you're describing. The first GUI application that I tried to make with a snap had no fonts whatsoever. The menus didn't render correctly, and PNGs didn't render correctly. And I've fixed all of those problems, and it now looks like a themed Ubuntu Mate application again. And that took some changes in Snapcraft to support that, or rather Snapd to support that, and learning how to do this stuff, and then that got abstracted away into the way you build snaps. So don't assume that all applications are going to look like that by default. Just take it that somebody has made a VLC snap of a pre-release version of VLC, and they may well still be finding their way with how to actually.
That was sort of my impression when I used it. And I think that, you know, and when you see that represent itself in a couple of different ways, that's funny, people will jump on it. Remember when LibreOffice shipped their first snap and it was way bigger than it needed to be? People jumped all over that.
Yeah, and that's another thing. You know, you have all the debug symbols in there by default at the moment, for example. And, you know, and unless you... There are mechanisms to say these are the only bits that I want in the SquashFS file system. This is the stuff that is the runtime and the executables, for example, and you can ignore all of these things. And the first few times you make a snap, you just include everything because you just want to get the thing to work. And then once you've got something that works and looks right, then you can start refining it and actually trimming it down.
You know, and just as an indication of how early days all this stuff is, I ran into an issue during my Fedora 24 review where I was trying to install GIMP and it just downloaded an empty repo folder into my home directory. It turns out that was a bug in Flatpak. I was hitting a bug and I didn't realize that. I thought I was just doing the commands wrong. And I got a note back from our review as a bit of feedback saying, yeah, turns out bug. We fixed it now. So it is super early days for all this stuff. And it's so what that when I what I guess what I'm trying to convey is not only is it early days for the backend implementation, like the store, what its source code is, how the packages are delivered, but it's also early days for all the people that are packaging the software. And I feel like right now in terms of snaps, I feel like we're up against a wall that's about to break, and then a whole bunch of snaps are going to come out, but there's not a whole bunch at the moment that you could just jump on.
You know, for from a dumb user perspective, because it was kind of an eye opening experience. I hadn't followed, you know, the snap packages and the Flatpak and the app image a whole lot prior to, obviously, until we, you know, covered it on the show. But prior to that, I knew that it existed, but I hadn't really played with it. And so my first foray into it was I went to download our app pick, which was the that image burner that Rikai had suggested, and it was an app image. And had no idea how to use it. I just downloaded it on the site and double-clicked on it, and it installed. And I was like, well, that's cool. Then I did it on like three other distros, and then that really started to click with me. And when I went to install my first snap package, I had no idea how to do that. And so I was Googling for snap packages, found one online, downloaded it from the website, tried to double-click on it like I did with app image, and that didn't work. And then I Googled around a little bit and found that you could do it from the command line.
Were you on Ubuntu or what were you on? Fedora?
That was Ubuntu. Yep.
Okay. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and so basically, I guess all that to say that if you are a person coming over from macOS or Windows, the software installation of AppImage functions exactly how you would expect it to, and you acquire software exactly how you would expect it to. And because it's cross distro, I know you no longer have to worry about training users to search for XYZ on Ubuntu rather than XYZ on Linux.
You know,
no updates.
I feel like your criticism right there is temporary. I feel like the next Ubuntu, say the next release, even they just have to associate the snap files association with an application that can install.
Okay, but every distro has to do that for that to work.
No,
hang on a minute. Okay, Noah, you say that you downloaded an app image and you double clicked on it and it just did stuff.
It did not. Yes, that is right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to make it executable.
Did I? Yeah. Maybe I did. Yeah.
Because
I tried making the snap executable, and that didn't double click though.
No, you're right. It's not associated with anything.
I had to download it. I had to make it executable, and then I could execute it. And
yeah, you're probably right. See, that's the problem.
And I felt that it wasn't. So we looked at Etcher, because Etcher's that, you know, disk creation utility that runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux.
Yep,
and
that's what I'm talking about. Actually,
rewriting all of our how to make a USB drive using Etcher so that every platform could use one tool.
Mm-hmm.
But the process of actually installing Etcher on Linux is so alien to how people would install things on Linux. What we're actually going to do is write the instructions for Windows and Mac to use Etcher and then use GNOME disks for Linux, because
can we just talk about that for a second?
Wow.
That, you know, a distribution is in the position where it is easier to write how to get it set up under Mac and Windows than it is under Linux. That right there perfectly defines the problem we are trying to solve. I'm not arguing for the replacement of repositories. I'm not calling for the end of Debs and RPMs, but that right there is so such a wonderful illustration of the problem. That's amazing.
Well, but so I guess, so what would be the alternative, that we allow by default for applications to when you download off the app, for them to run?
No, fast forward 5 years from now, and let's just say Flatpak snaps or app images have taken off. One of them is so predominant that you can pretty confidently write a how-to and say download this app image. And you can almost know with absolute certainty that they've downloaded an app image before and they know how to install it. Or if it's a snap, they know what that's about. And so now imagine what Wimpy's process would be. He'd have the same download page. He'd say, here's the instructions for Windows. Here's the instructions for Mac. And if you want to do it under Linux, download this snap. And he could link to the most recent snap, or he could link to the uBrowse page or whatever it is, uApps page. And it would just be double-click the snap and follow the instructions when it launches. It would literally be a less instruction set than it is for Windows. I mean, it's a fundamental shift in the friction, and it's a fundamental reduction in that friction for users to start with Matei. I mean, do you think I'm wrong, Wimpy, or do you think I'm right?
No, you are right. We're constantly trying to find ways to make to lower the barriers to entry, and for many reasons, Snaps and universal package installers solve a number of problems. And the thing is that you've talked about putting snaps on the vendor or, you know, author's website so people can download a snap and install it the same way that Windows users do. I feel that's a bit of a retrograde step because I think the central repository where you can search for, find, and install applications from one place is the superior mechanism, but snaps support both paradigms. You can have a snap store or many snap stores,
mm-hmm.
depending on, you know, if you've got an IoT device that, or a NAS, you know, and the NAS vendor wants their own snap store. But companies like Viber, for example, could make snaps and have them download off their website. So both paradigms are supported with snaps, and I think that's that's a particularly useful use case.
Do you think it's going to be problematic, though, for users if sometimes you obtain it from a central software center and other times you have to go to the...
I do, and that's why I would prefer to see that people embrace the snap store paradigm and we keep what we're used to and what mobile phone users and tablet users are used to, mm-hmm. which is all of your applications are in a central repository.
And frankly, what macOS and Windows are going to, right? Both have an application store.
Well, and iOS and Android.
So how about this? Would there be a way for somebody to add, if the snap is on a website, would there be for somebody else to take it off their website and add it to the store? And then would the reverse be true? Would it be possible for somebody like me who really likes to have local copies of things to be able to download those snap packages and store them on my device?
Yeah. So when I build a snap package, for example, I build it locally on my computer and I end up with an architecture specific snap. So an AMD 64 snap. And the snap is a SquashFS file system that encompasses the application and all of the shared libraries and assets that application needs to run. That snap file you can install by typing snap install path to snap.snap file. So you can download a snap and install it. If you wanted to download all of the snaps in the world and stick them on a USB hard drive and carry it around with you and install from those, you could do that.
I mean, if you have the snap YAML file, the snapcraft YAML file, you can build your own.
If you've got the YAML file, you can build it yourself.
So, Daredevlin, what do you think about it being a centralized repository and that being with Canonical? Because don't you think then that means every single aspect of getting these snaps into the central repository has to be as easy and simple as possible? And I don't think we're there yet. What do you think?
What I think is, essentially, I agree with Wimpy in that I prefer the model to have a repository. And if we want to see the repository still to prevail as the way to install packages, what we have essentially to do is just make the process easier for third parties to come and put their package in. And once we do that, there's no excuse to why they're not deploying through that mechanism and why they are distributing, you know, through their website instead. And perhaps make it easy to make their website put something that, you know, like you do in Android, you're on a website, it detects that it's an application from the Play Store and opens the Play Store. You might want something that is similar to that, that goes and opens your software center and installs the snap. So the website will not actually have a download, but actually something that opens the store and makes you install through it.
Rotten, I wanted to give you a chance to jump in and just, I was curious your thoughts about the process right now of getting into that central store.
Yeah, it's actually very easy. Like Wimpy was talking about how he builds the snaps locally, you don't have to do that. You can actually just make the YAML file and then send it to, and Launchpad will build it for you through the Snapcraft tool and create all the architectures snaps that you want, and you just push it to the store. And if you if you are a part of a project and you are like the official person, you get the namespace of the official project. If you're not, you get, for example, Telegram. It's Telegram dash the name of the guy who did it. Then, so that way you can, there's no one fighting over namespace. So then to get into the store is very simple. And as long as your stuff runs and when, you know, it doesn't break anything, it's all good and you get it in there. And then if you have, let's say you see a bug and you want to fix it, you just do it again through Launchpad, push it to the store, and then the user gets the access to it and gets the update.
Hmm. Yeah.
It actually is.
So it sounds like the biggest inconvenience. Easier. Sounds like the biggest inconvenience is you have to have a Launchpad account. Not everybody likes
yeah, that's
maybe.
About the size of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for some, that's a deal breaker.
And don't
good thing it's free and open source. The Launchpad is. So.
Yeah.
And the Ubuntu Snap Store implementation is just a Snap Store implementation. I think others will sprout up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want there only to be one, because then if there is more than one, there creates more availability issues. But if there was a structure, for example, like Ubuntu's store was like the core base that you could build on top of and have your own snaps. But if you don't have a snap for a particular application, it kind of is like a fallback.
Yeah,
that would be fantastic.
Or it could end up like repos, where you could have multiple. You could have your local installation of Snap pointed at multiple repos, just like you can with Flatpak today. It could be like that too. It might not be hard coded to a single story. Maybe you could have, you know, let's say I'm Ubuntu Mate. I could have when my users launch their version of the Software Center, it could be looking at all of Canonical's Snap Store and a Ubuntu Mate Snap Store that maybe has the welcome screen in it and maybe a menu launcher and a few other things that, you know, they've created that to ease the process. And maybe it's only four or five things. Just like today, Antergros does repo priority, and you have Antergros's repo at the top, and then they have the regular main repos, and they can pull from all the different sources. Just like a lot of like we see today with a lot of derivatives, only this would be a Snap version, and it might not have support for it today. Snap and local Snapd and all that might not have support for multiple stores today, but this is an open source project. I mean, in a year, it could do 10 times what it does today.
Right. It has support for a store, like having your own custom store now, like, you know, and it's only been like 2 weeks since that was even announced, like they were doing the different distro stuff. So that's already been proving that they're going to do other things. But there's actually something that a lot of people aren't aware of, is that when you have a snap in the store, you actually don't just have that snap and that branch. You have multiple branches. You have the stable branch, the unstable branch, the constant testing branch, so you can actually have like betas and all this, and it's all still one snap that you control. The user can select which branch they want to use. So if they want absolute latest, they can get it.
What about licensing issues, like for, you know, Adobe Reader or Adobe Flash or something like that? I guess more specifically, I guess here's my question. The concern I have about the whole repo idea is you're going to wind up with, I'm afraid that anyway, that you're going to wind up with some distros having certain repos and those repos not being added by default in other distros. And so what you wind up with is, again, certain packages available in one distro and not in another.
Well, but they're all snaps. They're all snaps. You can always just grab the snap.
Right, if you know where to. But
yeah,
I guess,
right. Yeah, here's what I think though about that. For when it comes to licensing and stuff like that, I don't know if there's a direct answer, because for all we know, in 6 months, Snap or Flatpak could have an option at install where it enables user prompting to accept EULAs, and so that I'm not so worried about. But the point I think you're touching on is, if something were to happen where you had multiple stores and you had, like the chat room's talking about, multiple people submit Telegram, how would you know which Telegram is the one that's the most secure, most updated, most reliable? I think what you would see if that truly existed, and I think you're going to like this answer, is the market would respond by creating a directory, like GNOME files and like the UAP browser that's already created. There, the open source community will step up and create a platform where you'll have everything indexed. You'll have comments. You'll have votes. You'll have just like the AUR or just like GNOME files, right? It'll be
So I don't use the AUR as much as you do, but you know, I go back to the most effective way for me to research products nowadays is I go to Amazon and sort by number of reviews. And if 10,000 people bought something and really liked it, I know that I can trust and buy that same product and probably have a good experience.
Right.
If we could bring that to software, geez, man.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. Exactly. I think the market, that's just what happens. So, Wimpy, is there something you want to jump in before we wrap up? Because I didn't plan to talk about this for that long, but I wanted to give you the last shout.
I can't remember.
Okay. No problem. No problem. You know what? I'll just say this. We should probably move on because right now as we record this, there is actually a news event happening. And we're like, I don't even know how long into the show and we haven't even mentioned it. If you get to the point where you want to host your own flat packs, your app images, or your own Snap Store, DigitalOcean.com. Use the promo code DOUNPLUGGED. Support this show and get a $10 credit. Man, DigitalOcean is great because it's all KVM. So the virtualizer, just my opinion, the best virtualizing platform I have ever used. KVM is the bee's knees. They've stacked that on top of SSDs. Of course, it's all running on top of Linux. 40 gigabit E connections into the hypervisors, data centers all over the world, and literally the best interface they could have possibly built sitting on top of the shenanigans. I don't know how they do it. And the nice thing is it's all HTML. And even if it was if they had a native app that worked this good, I'd be like, man, they got a great desktop app, and then they have a functional website. No, it's like better than I would have ever expected even from a native app. It is extremely functional. You get HTML5 console access to your rigs. You can deploy SSH keys to multiple machines at a time. You can spin up applications like the entire freaking stack from everything from the kernel of whatever distro you chose all the way up to the final crazy Ruby on Rails application you want to run or just the base system. They got data centers in New York, San Francisco, Singapore, Amsterdam, London, Toronto, Germany, India. They're growing like crazy, and they've matched this great interface that I just freaking love with a super cool API, an API that's so straightforward and simple and something they take seriously that a really great community has cropped up and built a ton of open source code around that. Speaking of community, they have some of the best documentation out there. Literally, even if you're not a DigitalOcean customer, it's still one of the best resources out there. Check it out because they take that very seriously, which means between the application stacks they have available, the base distros they have to choose from, and their documentation, experts and beginners can make super, super good use out of a DigitalOcean droplet. They also have hourly pricing available, and because you can spin up and destroy a rig in a matter of seconds, with snapshots you can restore and get right back to where you're at. It's really nice to take advantage of their hourly pricing. And when you use our promo code DOUNPLUGGED, one word, lowercase, you get the $10 credit. That hourly pricing is going to last you forever. So if you want to experiment with something on a machine that has a crazy great internet connection, tons of CPU, you want to have multiple people banging on it, you want to put it in production for yourself, if you want something you can access between your work and your home and also on your mobile device and not have to mess around and futz with your crappy router, DigitalOcean. Just use the promo code DOUNPLUGGED. And if you ever get to a point where you're ready to put this thing in production, it'll work. It'll do it. And they make it easy to expand the machines, too, especially now with the new block storage beta program. You know, right now, Jupyter Broadcasting is taking advantage of DigitalOcean's infrastructure like never before. It's so nice to know that when we just want to try a concept, we can mess around on DigitalOcean. We don't have to worry about the costs. We know we get great performance. And we're ready to go into production. We have enterprise-grade features like their API, like the snapshot capability, like the application stack deployments. And
Chris
now... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're slowly moving your studio up to the quote-unquote cloud. It's just a cloud that you can control so that you can get to it from anywhere in your RV.
I was just going to say, and now with the new team features, I'll just never have to worry about it and let Noah do everything. Oh! DigitalOcean.com. Yeah, well, that's Rikai's got the post-production work. Noah's got the server-side work. And, you know, also they make it nice. If you want to set something up for a client and transfer it to them, you can transfer droplets. It's a pretty great service. DigitalOcean.com. Just use the promo code DOUNPLUGGED. And a big thanks to DigitalOcean. So I was saying there's a news event going on right now. I got a little audio to get you in the mood. For those of you that didn't know, and I considered making it, but I would have had to mess with the whole road trip plans that I have right now, so I couldn't do it. But going on right now is Red Hat Summit, or as the Red Hat folks that I've been talking to call it, Summit. Summit is going on right now, and I got a little audio to put you in the mood. Ooh. Now, no,
I always heard about it. You know,
you might be a little jealous.
I'm new to Red Hat. I've only been doing it for over a year now. My job thought it would be a great idea and a great experience for me to come to Red Hat Summit.
My excitement here is to learn about a lot of things that I heard this morning, 12 plus new release announcements. I'm like, yes, and I'm just looking forward to the next 4 days.
I mean, there's so much going on around application development, containers, which is part of my world.
I think there's a, you know, opportunity to figure out what's going on all in one place.
You have a lot of vendors at Summit who are starting to embrace open source in new ways.
One of the things that we're really trying to talk about with customers is the fact that we have this cross-portfolio experience, including services, and it's not just product by product, and these solutions can really help them solve specific problems.
All right. I was excited. I was stoked until that last executive spoke there, and then the entire thing kind of lost me.
Why?
You didn't hear it, did you?
Customers is the fact that we have this cross-portfolio experience.
Okay, so one of the things we're trying to communicate to customers is that we have this cross-portfolio experience. Okay.
Yeah.
Including services, and it's not just product by product. And these solutions can really help them solve specific problems.
I'm going to play it once in its entirety, Noah, and then once it's done, I want you to tell me what she just said, okay?
Trying to talk about with customers is the fact that we have this cross-portfolio experience, including services, and it's not just product by product, and these solutions can really help them solve specific problems.
I think she's just saying that Red Hat Solutions stretch across a so they partnered with, or they're working with Microsoft, and they're working very hard with all of the different problems that exist in the IT sphere, and they have hired industry experts and have them available to solve those problems.
All right, so
do they have derp learning?
Yeah. All right, soon. Okay. So that's what you think. All right, no, that was a good try. That was a good solid effort. We have good. We got nice music. Ooh. Yeah, okay. So, I'm digging this piece overall. Wimpy, could you explain to me what she said?
Yeah, they've got derp words.
You know, that wasn't helpful, actually. That didn't help.
Chris, you of all people should understand this. That poor woman is standing there with her computer, and she's working on a couple of things, and everyone is like tapping her on the shoulder, and finally this guy turns around, he's like, "Hey, I'm John from the media marketing department, and we're going to shoot this thing about, we're interviewing people, so tell us about Red Hat." And she told him, she's like, "I'm not really good on camera. I don't. You'll be fine. I don't even really know. You'll be fine. Here, we're gonna start rolling. Okay, go." And then that's what came out.
That's definitely a possibility.
That's totally what happened.
I think what it was. Now, here's what I think it was, Noah. And picture it, okay? It's 2 days before the floor opens. You finally just got all the banners up. The executives are arriving for their pictures. Whoa, who's getting aggressive in the mumble room? Daredevil, you were getting aggressive there in the mumble room. Everybody's arrived for their pictures. You haven't actually opened the doors yet, but from a corporate standpoint, you have decided what your core message about this entire event is. So you get your marketing team there with their DSLR camera, and you say,
"At Summit, who are starting to embrace open source in new ways."
One of the things that we're really trying to talk about with customers is the fact that we have this cross-portfolio experience, including services, and it's not just product by product, and these solutions can really help them solve specific problems.
What I love about it is she ends with, "These solutions can help them solve specific problems." What's so corporately wonderful about it is we can help you solve your specific problem after making the most vague possible generalized statement we could ever come up with. That's what's so amazing about it. And I really respect Red Hat as a company, but when they actually outwardly communicate, so they don't actually allow all the cool people in the company to brag and talk about all the neat stuff they're doing. And so when they communicate with their Red Hat voice, even their CEO, who seems like a pretty great guy, communicates in this style that feels like Microsoft at its clumsiest.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I guess the problem is you're dealing with a couple of things, right? You're dealing with the most litigious country in the entire world.
Yeah, that's such a tired Red Hat excuse.
It's so true. When you have a company that big that's worth that much money, walking around with a constant target on their butt.
Meanwhile, companies that are jillions of times larger have their top CEO, top people sitting down and talking to podcasters about anything the podcaster asks them. That's such a tired, tried excuse for all of the things that are wrong with Red Hat and Fedora. I'm just sick of it.
I guess I would agree with you, and you, I know for a fact, you've been there with me. I would agree with you if it wasn't for the fact that we've talked to those people and what they say on camera and what they're able to say off camera.
I think there is a culture problem at Red Hat, and I think the employees absolutely fear all these legal things. I think they all are the biggest bunch of paranoid people out there. I mean, it is ridiculous.
Given their clientele, do you think is the community involvement or a better presence just not in their interest in the long-term fiscal sense?
I think given their clientele, it's expected this is how you communicate. So it's part of the reason they communicate this way.
Yeah, that might be part of it. Every time that we've had somebody on camera – it seems like they follow this strict rudimentary procedure, and then you get them off camera and they're geeks just like you and me. And that just tells me that they have hired legal people that have specifically told them, hey, these are the things that you don't want. These are the approved things that you say, because these are the things that we can guarantee.
Right. Sure. That does feel like what they say. Why is it that no other companies like that? No other company we talk to, no other company in the Linux ecosystem has these same concerns. Other people are worried about these particular issues, but nobody is literally petrified. The employees from Red Hat are terrified of this particular issue. Nobody else is like that.
What's the downside?
None of them is. I'd claim that none of them is as big as Red Hat, and that's one thing, and they have to be risk takers if they want to be in the platform discussing when Red Hat is discussing things.
You know what?
I will also claim that they mention solutions, which is, you know, keyword to we provide for everything, but without committing to any specifics. So yeah, you come with us, you talk with us.
Yeah.
What we're really trying to talk about with customers is the fact that we have this cross-portfolio experience, including services, and it's not just product by product, and these solutions can really help them solve specific problems.
You know, I've heard that 30 times, and it still just doesn't make any sense. And I guess it doesn't matter. It's just a point of how they communicate. That's my main point.
They need some cross-vocabulary solutions.
Maybe they have
some
specifics.
Just think which company provides products and always advertises their products, and it's their competitor while they're providing solutions, and that will be more pleasant to their customers to hear.
Yeah.
Just think about that. Who's that? Usually Canonical, for example.
Yeah.
Focus on their products. It's their.
What's the downside, have these, Chris, of saying something like that? Like, where is it problematic?
It sounds like disingenuous bullshit by people that don't actually even know the very products they're selling, and which makes me have doubt in the people that run the company. But because there's a clear communication style.
Isn't that doubt alleviated from the people that do have the expertise?
No, because they're not the ones making the decisions. The people making the decisions don't even know the product.
Right, and they're not listening to that spiel anyway. They don't care. The deals are made elsewhere, right?
But I feel like the entire culture at Red Hat is the idea that anyone in the company has the ability to offer input, and there is no top-down hierarchy. And that was the entire purpose of Jim Whitehurst's book, was that he thought he was going to go into this company and teach them how to run a company from the top down. And what it taught him was that that's not the way that a company is run.
Okay.
Not so much.
That does sound.
That's the way pretty much every corporate company, corporate entity speaks when they do any kind of press.
Yeah.
Like, what is hurting Red Hat in this case? Maybe it's because no one listens to what they say because they never say anything.
That is exactly it. And I don't really, I guess I wish we weren't dwelling on this because I'd rather move on. But my point is when you don't speak clearly, you don't connect to the Linux audience. If you have an audience in the open source, this is a summit for technical people. Okay, this is not a marketing event. This isn't CES. This isn't something for consumers. This is at the Red Hat Summit for people who are sysadmins and people that make their livings on Red Hat systems, right? So I think I want to be clear. This is an introduction to why you as a technical person should come to the summit that was posted on the Red Hat YouTube channel.
I guess that wasn't my impression of Red Hat Summit. I thought it was for more like high-level,
there's people VARs there and all kinds of stuff. And another group of people there is Microsoft. And they made some huge announcements at Red Hat Summit, which I think is sort of a big news story kind of in itself, is that Microsoft is making these announcements at a Red Hat Summit. The company announced the general availability of .NET Core and ASP.NET Core 1.0. The Microsoft announcement is kind of a big deal at Red Hat Summit. And one of the motivations in open sourcing .NET is they really want to collaborate more with Red Hat. And Red Hat has a couple of web pages dedicated on their website now to making Red Hat the premier .NET platform. The .NET Foundation will be the steward of overall .NET development, and Red Hat just joined that foundation. So that's kind of a big deal. That's one of the, that's an example of some of the folks that are at the summit.
And it's really Microsoft kind of delivering on this promise of opening .NET and getting it running on Linux, right?
Yeah. Well, they seem to have some serious motivation because they announced that nearly 1 in 3 Azure virtual machines are now running Linux. Microsoft is sort of seeing a huge growth because just the same time last year, they said 1 in 4. So now they've gone in a year, at least according to Rusinovich, who runs Azure. It says Microsoft's gone from 1 in 4 of its Azure virtual machines to 1 in 3. And The other two-thirds are just Azure customers running Windows servers and virtual machines. So they're seeing a big uptick for Linux at Azure. And, you know, it's one of the reasons Linux Academy has launched Azure training, is it's just big over there. So, yeah, that's a big – I don't know, guys. To me, that seems like
The Microsoft stuff changes how I think about it a little bit. Like, I wouldn't previously – like, if I was going to make a project, I wasn't going to start it on .NET and maybe Java if I want, like, a nice object-oriented, garbage-collected, et cetera. But if they're going to have first-class Linux support and, you know, really stand behind like that, then, I mean, they don't – they make some good software. They have a lot of talented engineers there. If they're really down with the openness, then maybe it's something to be worthwhile.
So I just looked at the registration. It's $1,600 for the full pass to go there. So it and to me this seems like a the OSCON and the LinuxCon of conferences, except it based more on Linux. And so in that regard, I don't know that highly technical, down to earth, you know, unfiltered, you know, technical talk is necessarily the most appropriate in a marketing video.
Dude, you are really just all in with Red Hat.
Well, I really am. I'm not. I guess I'm just
so,
not.
You're telling me. I mean, I feel like this is sort of almost like it doesn't even need explaining. But who are the number one attendees of OSCON? You know, we've talked to them.
A lot of big business people that could care less about.
No, those are the VARs. Those are the people at the booths. The attendees are sysadmins and dev guys who are sent there by their company because their company's paying for the ticket. That's the people around the floor. Those are the people attending the talks. That's, I mean, come on. Those are the people filling up those rooms listening to the talks.
I guess you're right there. I mean, there's definitely a large majority of those, but there's also a healthy majority of people that are, you know, that are just, you know, decision makers, just, you know, executive types that are there to learn about their technology too. They're not actually the ones implementing that stuff, the low level developer kind of people. But you're right. I mean, we walked into that. There's a whole group of people that we talked to at OSCON, I think, and all of them. I think the
funnier thing is that you're bringing it back up after we moved on.
I went and looked at their website and I was like, all right, well, let's hint a little bit. I'm looking at their keynote speakers and I'm looking. There's a guy from Target. There's a guy from Intel. There's a guy from Dell. It very much feels like a very corporate-y conference, and it seems like corporate-y speak is appropriate there.
So what do you think about Red Hat Enterprise being the premier platform to build .NET on a proven and trusted enterprise Linux? .NET on Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Get started right now if you go to developers.redhat.com/.net. Are you excited, Noah?
I am excited that a company like Microsoft is going to have the incredible influence of Red Hat over them to help them push them in the right direction.
Well, that's a very political way to say that. That is very nice. Very nice.
Maybe something will rub off.
Are you okay if we move on, or do we got to hug it out, man?
No, we're good.
I mean, because, you know, I know you don't like it when we talk bad about your Red Hat.
No, it's okay. Just Red Hat is why I'm on Linux, is because they made such an amazing product.
All right. Well, speaking of running Linux, I have been running Linux Mint 18. And I got to tell you, it's not so bad. By the time you're probably getting this down, listened, if you're a download audience member, Linux Mint 18, Cinnamon and Mate editions will likely be released. Softpedia noticed it a little earlier thanks to a tipster. They have links to the ISO downloads, which are in our show notes. And this is as of June 28th. Now, this is the new version after a lot of talk about XApps and all of that kind of stuff. It has the new of Cinnamon 3.0 goodness in it that probably a lot of you have been anticipating if you're a Cinnamon user. And this release is going to be supported until 2021. So this is something that'll be around for a while. In fact, it'll be the base of future releases until 2018. So like I was mentioning, this has the new X apps in it, which I had a chance to try out a little bit. It has high DPI support, well, at least much improved high DPI support. It has the brand new info screen when you launch the update manager for the first time that gives you a little bit more clarification about the different upgrade options. What is there? Somebody like – there is somebody going on with the jacks on the back. I don't know what's going on out there. It's got the new theme that is based on Arc and the Mocha icon theme, the Mint Y theme, which actually when you put it in dark mode looks pretty nice. It looks pretty nice. So this is the new Mint 18 sort of at a very high level. I've only been using it for like 3 hours, so I only have very, very first impressions. I did hit a few bumps, so I want to give you guys a few warnings and things like that. Anybody in the Mumble Room had a chance to try any of the betas of Mint 18 or been looking at it as the release has been getting closer?
I've been doing competitor research, yes.
Oh, really? And what has your reconnaissance shown you?
It's Linux Mint. Same stuff, but newer.
So that was sort of my impression, too, and I was actually kind of hoping you would have more because I didn't have much. That's kind of all I got.
Sorry for stealing your wind.
Yeah, you did, and my wind was not much. I had very little wind, which
well,
is not normal
right
for
now,
me.
I think right now, like what we were talking about, at least when we're talking about like 17.1, etc., I think we kind of know what Linux Mint is, and where they really shined in the past was on some of that polish and integration, and it's kind of hard to assess that this close after release, right? So maybe in a week or two, we can see really, are they excelling at what they're trying to do or not?
Yeah, I actually think wait a week or two would be good advice because so I decided to put this on the Librem, which is, as you guys are probably well aware, a laptop built to run Linux. No, did you know that? What are you laughing about? It's a laptop built to run Linux. What's the problem?
What's undoubtedly about to leave your mouth?
So the Linux Mint first pass on the install wouldn't work. It warned me about some UEFI issue, basically that I had another OS on there and that if some shenanigans were to occur with a BIOS emulation that I may not be able to boot into their OSs, to which I said the entire reason I'm installing Mint is to not boot into those other OSs, so go ahead and nuke and pave. All right? That's your problem solved.
Oh, no.
What?
You didn't switch the hard drive, did you?
No.
Okay, so we just blew away our OBSs. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. Sorry yeah, and I realized that, and I realized it doesn't boot. It's just, so it doesn't boot at all. So that's good. So that's sweet. And then I did manage to get it to boot, but I don't know why, but my Wi-Fi is not working. And I haven't. And that's kind of – so I just ended up using Ethernet USB adapter to play around because I didn't have time to troubleshoot the Wi-Fi at the moment. I did notice the settings control panel is also a little cleaned up, and there's the – you know. The new theme and all that, and the new version of Cinnamon is really nice. It's a
Can
really
you
nice desktop.
To click yet?
So I tried to figure that out for you because I thought you might ask me that, and they've removed the mouse and trackpad control panel applet from the settings thing.
Good, now you might
some stuff
That's
you can
great.
Still search for. Like so, for example, if you wanted to search for proprietary drivers, you no longer can find like the drivers or software sources entry in the settings. But if you search good. For it in your Mint menu, it will come up.
Ah, that's good. That makes a lot of sense. I'm glad to hear that.
So yeah, it looks like
I was going to ask if we can enable touch to click.
Yeah, right. I know. No, not Noah. No, not Noah.
I hate to click. I don't just and I don't
Some
mean
of us
like
click
I don't
during
just, like,
the show, Noah.
Quietly yeah. click.
Here's the thing is, I actually not only I don't just like kind of dislike it. I actively like I can't stand it. I can't even use a computer if it has tapped.
He gets super grumpy, Wes. And then if it's like 1 a.m, he gets like all diva about it. It's bad. It's real bad.
We don't want that.
And you can ask Rikai. My son Dylan was over here at the house last night at the studio. And he was going on a rant about trackpads, and then him and Rikai started labeling me as a trackpad supporter. As a
Yikes.
I know it started getting heated in my own studio over trackpads. So and I'm just a trackpad indifference. That's all. I don't like them, but I don't dislike them that much. And
exactly.
I started taking a lot of trackpad heat. So Noah, you are leading a revolution. You know who else is leading a revolution? That'd be Red Hat. In their communication.
One of the things that we're really trying to talk about with customers is the fact that we have this cross-portfolio experience, including services, yeah. and it's not just product by product, and these solutions can really help them solve specific problems.
Chris?
Yeah.
Chris. trackpad works under Fedora, just saying.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah, the new libinput, huh? Yeah, that is nice. That
I can go ahead and disable Taptic-like. It's fantastic.
You know, the first time I used the new Fedora 24, there was like 20 seconds where the mouse felt really weird. And then... yeah, go ahead.
Were you looking for, are you looking for cross-cursor solutions?
Yeah, could you have any specifics? Because I wonder if you don't have it from any specific division, maybe as a service. All right, so this is, can you tell this is my last LUP for a week? Yeah, I know, right? All right, before we get into these desktop killers that Wimpy and I have been drooling over, and I think, Noah, you're perfectly suited as an Oryx Pro owner and as somebody who also has the 13-inch side of this, we're going to talk about... is Linux technically dead on the desktop? Not because of Linux itself, but because, just statistically speaking, in 10 years, 5 years, is the desktop really going to be necessary? We have a couple of new products out in the market that are just unbelievably powerful, and they're portable. I can't even – as somebody who works in video production, I can't even believe I'm about to ask this question. But realistically, I got to look at the specs. I got to look at the sales stats, and I got to ask the question. So before we go there, let's go somewhere nice. Let's go to this new – oh, there it is. There's the one just on time. There's that weed whacker. Good. This is we've added that weed whacker in post. We sweeten up the Linux Academy spot. We wanted to make sure – you know what else? And then we add a few other things. Like we brought in Bill Hammer from – or Himmer from Fox News. See? There's Bill, so that's nice. And Megyn Kelly's here too to help us.
OMG, OMG, OMG.
I don't know why. But we also have a little background music for Linux Academy. That's right. Go over to linuxacademy.com/unpluggedfriends and look at that new site. Oh, look at that site. Oh, friends. Look at that thing. They I tell you what, they ain't stopping over at Linux Academy. They're adding new content all the time. They've expanded their staff to make sure the old stuff stays relevant. It's Linux enthusiasts, trainers, developers, educators, they've came together, they created the Linux Academy platform. And you can get started at linuxacademy.com/unplugged. You get a great discount. They have hands-on labs, so you get to work with this stuff. Instructor mentoring when you need to talk to humans. Video courses with self-paced, in-depth courses where you get a download, comprehensive study guide. The courseware automatically adjusts to the distribution you want to use. Learning plans, learning paths, availability planners. All of these things help you structure a learning plan when you don't have a lot of time. So if you get busy, going on a road trip, those kinds of things, you're going to Tokyo, Linux Academy's got your back. I like that too for the, this is like when you're just, you only got an hour. They got nuggets, deep dives. They have iOS and Android applications. They have note cards that can be forked to help you study. And they have a super active community packed full of Jupiter Broadcasting members.
Or if you have 13 hours of free Wi-Fi on an airplane over to Tokyo, then you could continue to learn while lounging about on an airplane.
I like that. In business class, too, at that, you suave
right.
Son of a gun.
That's right.
Getting your knowledge on it, linuxacademy.com/unplug. Go check them out. They're growing like crazy. It's a really great platform committed to expanding Linux. All of the technologies, Linux core technologies, and also the technologies built on top of Linux Academy. Go there now, because time, my friends, is running out. LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. And a big thank you to Linux Academy for sponsoring the Unplugged program. And thank you to that weed whacker for adding a little bit of extra context to that spot.
A little extra buzz.
Yeah, you know, a little bit of layers, a little bit of flavor. So there's this guy named Martin Wimpress. I don't know who he is, but he's got a lot of nerve teasing me like this. This son of a gun over here posts that Entroware will soon be announcing a new laptop that he had the privilege of naming, the Entroware Athena. Well, Wimpy, that sounds pretty cool. Tell me about the process of naming a computer and maybe a little bit of backstory here about the Athena, and then the big reveal, if you will.
Okay, so I obviously have a relationship with Entroware, and I've known that they've been working on this computer for some months now. And as it was getting close, it had like a code name, and we were exchanging details using the code name. And then they sort of said, oh, we're going to call it this. And I was like, oh, okay. I said, we're thinking of calling it this. And I was like, oh, I'd like coming up with a name. So I came up with the name Athena, which they liked. So it's the Entroware Athena.
That is pretty. And Athena, is there any special relevance or connection to the name?
Well, all of their machines are named after Greek gods and goddesses. And I like the classics, and Athena, I think, is the most interesting of the goddesses. So she's the goddess of war and peace and wisdom and craft and all sorts of things. So she's got more attributes than any of the others.
So this is a pretty well-specced machine, and depending on your different options, it could be a powerhouse. Now, a little birdie told me that you may have ended up purchasing one of these Athenas, so you must have had it for at least a bit, Wimpy. How is the machine? Why did you decide to purchase it? What are your experiences like? Tell us all about it.
So I have sold every computer I own in order to make some money to buy this. So once I knew this was on its way, I've been eBaying my computers. And I don't know if you remember, a few weeks ago, there was a sharp uptick in the Bitcoin price. It went up about 20%.
Oh, yeah, I did notice that, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So I cashed out some coins.
Between you, Noah, and I, we're playing the Bitcoin market for our hardware.
Yeah, to sort of cover the balance. So I've gone full metal Entroware Athena. So the one I have has got the Skylake i7 6820HK, which is a quad core, and that can push out at turbo 3.6 gigahertz.
Ooh.
64 gigs of DDR4 RAM.
All right.
I've only installed three of the hard drives at the moment, so I've got three SSDs in there at the moment. A 256 drive, which is boot, and two 1 terabyte drives.
No.
And I'll be adding another one. And the reason for the two 1 terabyte drives, one is for the home partition, and then I also create myself a second logon that's just called Steam, and I mount that second drive on /home/Steam so that all of the games sit in there, and then as I reinstall and what have you, I don't have to download all of my Steam stuff.
Oh, that's again. A really smart idea.
I put mine all on a drive called /big, and that's just like a pool of drives.
So that's a clever name. Hey, speaking of names, Wimpy, I have one question for you. Did you consider naming the laptop McLappy Face?
No, I didn't. I spoke about this on the Ubuntu podcast, and they all pointed out I missed the obvious thing, is that I should have called it the Entroware Martin. But I don't think anyone at Entroware would have gone for that. Yeah. Yeah. So this has got Intel Iris 530 Pro graphics in it, and it's also got an NVIDIA GTX 980M in it as well. So with Optimus switching.
Is that working?
You have to log out and log in, so it doesn't do Diane on the fly switching. I imagine if I messed about with Bumblebee, I could get that to go. But I'm using the Intel graphics. The only time I use the NVIDIA graphics is if I want to do some game playing, or I've just started recently experimenting with the NVENC stuff. Those tend to be specific work cases, and I'm quite happy to log out and log back in to handle that. But I wrote a utility forked a utility and extended it a little bit that sits in the tray, and it shows you which you're using, and you can just toggle and then log out, log in.
Wow, that is quite the machine. That's a multi-year machine, I can tell you. Somebody who's bought some workstation killers before.
Yeah.
Any chance these are going to be available in the US at some point?
There are no immediate plans for Entroware to ship in the US, as far as I'm aware.
Now,
but
is this? Yeah, go ahead.
I do know. Despite the politics in the UK last week, I do know Entroware are very close to launching in some European countries.
This seems very similar too to the Oryx Pro from System 76.
Does it?
Yeah, so Noah, you may already have something very similar to this rig.
I figured the ODM, manufacturer is probably the same, but it just
there are small differences, of course, across them, because they're both building them, assembling them separately, and making
right. And the other thing is in Wimpy and I had talked about this a little bit, is that, you know, various little components inside are sometimes different, and that leads to drastically different user experiences.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and this also you can get with Ubuntu Mate from IntroWare, which is kind of nice.
Yes, it arrived pre-installed with Ubuntu Mate 16.04.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Have you experimented with battery life much?
No. I haven't plugged it into the main since I received it. So I've been playing with it on and off during the day. I don't know how long we've been sat here this evening. So it's done several hours, and it's about halfway exhausted at the moment.
Well, congratulations. So, you know, now so this is where I started thinking about this. On the high end, you have these Athenas, Bonobos, Oryx Pros, these real desktop killers. They're not super portable, but they can get you a few hours. They can move you between your different work spots. And then on the other end, you now have very efficient performance and capabilities from something like the NUC Skull Canyon. So compare and contrast those two machines for me, Wimpy. Do you think when you look at the two spectrums there, is there less and less of a role for you with a traditional desktop tower that you assemble and you put together or you buy pre-built? Where's the tower fitting in?
Well, the tower computer that I bought in 2008 is one of the boxes that I've sold in order to make the funds available to buy this computer. So that computer back in the day in 2008 was a dual quad-core Xeon with 32 gigs of RAM. And it had two NVIDIA something or others in it at the time. So that was a fairly stonking machine when I bought that, and that just about expired. It still worked, but it was you know, breathless doing gaming, for example. So I've sold that, and it was massive, and it had a 750-watt power supply. By comparison, the Skull Canyon NUC is about three times faster than that quad-core Xeon from 2008 in terms of CPU performance. And this box had an NVIDIA, when I sold it, had an NVIDIA 680 in it. And the Skull Canyon NUC with its Iris Pro 540 could outperform it on 3D as well, you know, for gaming and what have you.
You know, isn't that something?
So I'm using NUCs. So I bought a NUC back in November, which I'm very happy with and I've still got. And the only reason I got the Skull Canyon NUC is because I'm about to replace my Plex server, and I thought I'd buy a NUC to be the Plex server, and I'd plug external drives into it over USB 3.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to find smaller form factor, lower power solutions. And then I thought, well, I've got this NUC, and it's really beefy. And then I saw the Skull Canyon was coming along. So what I've done is I've bought the Skull Canyon to become my new desktop workstation. And my old NUC, which is only 6 months old, is going to become the Plex server.
Oh, nice.
But the reason I like the NUCs is they're so small. I've now mounted my Skull Canyon NUC onto the back of my monitor. So everything's now behind the screen. And because I've got hubs and stuff built into the screen, you know, it's just tidy. You know, I had this massive sort of 40 kilo... Dell Precision workstation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it feels like it's got bricks in it.
Yeah, and now it's this tiny little device, and it's great. So I really like the NUCs. They're great workstations, and the one laptop I've kept is my Apollo. So I still have my Apollo. Mm. And that's my lightweight. I'm going out those of people that know me sort of see me in real life. I have a habit of going to do coding in the pub. It's one of my favorite pastimes.
That's the best place to go.
So I take myself away for sort of a couple of days, and I go and camp out in a pub and just sort of have a one-man sprint. And that Apollo is the computer that comes with me. And it's great for a one day, you know, you can go anywhere, you know the battery's going to last, you can get stuff done, it's lightweight, it's easy to carry. But when I go away for a bit longer, and I'm going to probably work on different things, I want something a bit more powerful. And one of the reasons that I've got this machine is because I run lots of virtual machines. So I've got the disk space for that now, and I've got the RAM and the CPU for it.
Yeah.
And we were talking about snaps earlier. when you build snap packages on your own machine, you can now do that by building them inside LXD containers. So each build is isolated and clean.
Nice.
But you can also build simultaneous snaps, different snaps simultaneously. So if you're working on several projects, you could actually have three or four snaps building. So another reason for this machine is that I can
have all the cores.
Absorb that workload, yeah.
Yeah, all the cores. Cool, Wimpy. Well, congratulations. And, you know, I, as somebody who recently just got a semi-upgraded desktop here in the studio, I feel like desktops aren't going away for me for a long time. I want capture cards. I want multiple drives.
I second that.
Cooling. But I think, and I would be curious really to get the audience's reaction to this, is if we remove ourselves from the equation and we, you know, we just, like, if you're looking at a chart and we just chop off our percentage, how many people realistically that are buying computers, say, from Best Buy or going into Costco, are really going to want desktop towers for much longer? It seems like that's a dying breed. Just, and it's not to be the, not to use the Steve Jobs analogy here, but it really does seem like cars versus trucks. There's going to be a lot less people driving trucks. And I don't think they're going away. But to that end, I think one of the hazards of it becoming a smaller and smaller market is the components are becoming crappier and crappier.
Yeah.
And when you build, you know, when you buy, when you're trying to build multiple machines and you're buying all the parts, most of the parts are bad. It's becoming more and more of a commodity, or I'm sorry, a niche market, and the parts are becoming more commoditized, and the quality is going down for the enthusiast market. And that's sort of the downside of it all. So that's why I think when you have companies like Entraware and companies like System 76 and you have Dells out there that are shipping Linux rigs, it's nice to have a good set of answers now for pre-built machines where they're being the front line for that kind of problems. But there are still options for the rest of us. So my question to the audience is, realistically, what's your over-under, what's your long shot on how much we have less left on desktop computing for average people? LinuxActionShow.reddit.com. That's where you go to leave your thoughts. I won't be here next week, but Mr. Noah will, and they have plenty of good things planned for you. So if you'd like to help them put together a great show, you can submit topics to LinuxActionShow.reddit.com, vote them up, and comment on them there. You can leave feedback at JupiterBroadcasting.com/contact. Don't forget to join us live over at JBLive.tv. We do the show live. Well, I don't. I assume you guys are doing it live at the regular time, Noah. But if you're not, JupiterBroadcasting.com.
We're doing it at 2 in the morning.
2 in the morning. Two in the morning. Great idea. Great idea.
Best time.
I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Somebody that shows up at 2 in the morning.
No, and we apologize already. Check the calendar, jupiterbroadcasting.com/calendar. Otherwise, it's out for download later on in the week. And don't forget your stickers at jupiterbroadcasting.com/stickers. And I'll see you back here in 2 weeks. There we go.
Is that a show?
That was it with no music. That was it. And we're not doing the Wesley, you missed, but we're not doing the music live anymore for a little bit.
Okay.
Which is hard for me. It's hard for me.
That's weird. Why?
I tried to convince him, Wes. I was telling him if he just put the theme song in Telegram, then he could play it to himself
sure.
in earphone.
Sure. Yeah. That makes total sense.
Oh, yeah. I would like that too.
JBTitles.com. Here. I'll show you, Wes. I'll tell you why. JBTitles.com. Everybody go boat. So here's the thing, Wes, as Noah would say, is now, Noah, you won't be able to hear this because I'm playing this on the computer that you're connected to.
Academy.
Oh, okay.
So prepare yourself for silence, Noah. I apologize about that. But
let's
see. This is going back to 150, right? So here we are, Wes. This is you and me kamutzing about a Kickstarter, $5,000. Okay. So they're scratching some itch. But it's, yeah, it's essentially a read-only live GNOME desktop with a decent GNOME theme.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't look
you
bad.
You can hear it? You know what, Wes?
Why is it a keyboard as well?
Well, because then it's the tamper-proof device where it freaks out when it gets broken.
Oh.
Yeah. You know what, guys? This is what it tells us. It doesn't matter about the technical. All right, so here we're about to start the intro music. Now, we didn't hear this live, Wes, during the show, but in post, it's obvious. Here it comes.
Right.
What it does tell you is that we are in the wrong business.
This is Linux Unplugged, episode 150 for June 21st, 2016.
Yeah, sounds horrible.
That's rough.
Yeah, so we're just going to play it in post, and then there'll be no processing of it. So, you know, I think what it is when we tried to level out all the different mumble levels, I think it just butchered the Muzak.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah. All right, jbtitles.com. Let's go, boat. Universal package paradigms, not just a packaging solution, snap it, pack it, ship it. Can we do 3 weeks of packaging? I don't know if we can, guys. Universal divide. That's not bad.
People love packaging.
Oh, dude, we love it.
Love it.
NOAA is number one. Entroware pub laptop going full Entroware. The Red Hat Summit.
Cross packaging solutions.
I think I owe Noah an apology because I upset him when I talked bad about his bae. I am sorry, Noah. I didn't mean to make you upset. My apologies.
I mean, here's the thing. You said something incorrect, and I corrected you. It's all right. You have the right to be incorrect. This is America.
Okay. All right. Good. Yeah. All right. So that's it. That's all it was.
Fuck the EU.
What? Don't say that.
I say balderdash.
JBTitles.com. JBTitles.com.
I experienced life in freedom.
I don't know about universal package paradigms. I don't know if I want my last show before vacation being titled about packaging. That feels like a failure on my part. Like I didn't show up for duty. Although we did have a good organic discussion about it.
They're fools.
JBTitles.com. Noah, have you gone? Do you see one you like? What about you, Wes? Did you see one you like? Thanks for making it, Wes. Where are you right now?
Yeah.
Where are you right now?
I'm at the beautiful East Hotel in downtown Portland.
Downtown Portland. I just, you know, last I heard you were just rubbing elbows with Linus, so.
You know, we're just best buds now.
Yeah.
He's a very nice guy face to face.
I heard you were making him breakfast.
He loves his eggs, bacon, and toast.
He made fun of my suit.
Yeah, that's true.
Rude.
That is true. Yeah, that is Noah's experience with Linus.
Yeah. I was at Linux, and I was there. A client had paid for my trip down there, and paid for the hotel and everything, and so I was representing them, and I was in a suit, and I was with there was other people there from the company, and I walked up, met him, and shook his hand, got my picture, and he's like, "Why are you wearing a suit?" And I'm like, well.
"That's amazing."
He's like, "You shouldn't wear a suit. This is you're the only person here wearing a suit. That's very strange. I don't know why you'd wear a suit here." And I'm like, "Well, not because other people think the company were wearing suits."
So
he questioned your Linux like credentials, right?
Basically,
there.
He's like, "Are you not?" He's like, "Are you not
my
a
nerdism?"
Yeah, exactly. That's rough, man. That's rough.
I got a chip on my.
You could never make a kernel.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I mean is true. I couldn't either. But like, whatever.
What do you guys think of Universal Divide? You like that?
I like the Universal Divide, yeah. I'm voting for it. I just voted for it.
I think.
Now it is 11.
Okay.
No, this is the chat room shout out.
No, chat room shout out right here.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. That's chat room shout out.
Okay.
Yeah. That's way different, Noah.
Is chat room shout out in the Dropbox?
Well, the soundboard, no. Yes. Well, probably everything's in the Dropbox at some place.
Okay. Maybe
the soundboard's right here on the machine, but yeah, I don't know about. I'm sure it's in there.
Okay.
Yeah, you're welcome, X Metal. You're welcome. That was a literal shout out. Yes, I do it for you guys because you guys are voting over at jbtitles.com. So Universal Divide looks like it's our winner.
Yep.
Sounds good.
Okay, guys. Well, thank you for being here. I appreciate it very much.
Chris, I'm gonna miss you a whole week. We're several without seeing you.
Oh. Oh. Wimpy, wait. You had Entroware news that I missed. What was that?
Oh, well, they were listening live, and they were just saying that the European shipping stuff is about to launch any day now. So if you're from Europe and you can hear this, coming soon, including keyboard options.
Hey, very nice. All right. Well,
I'm really pleased for them.
Everybody treat Noah nice. He may or may not be in the studio next week for love.
I think we should switch the Mumble server two or three times. Maybe change the website.
That'd be good.
Address.
Actually, that's all of that. Actually,
TeamSpeak is pretty good.
All of that's actually happening between now and the next show. So,
wait,
stop publishing to YouTube.
Yeah, really?
The Mumble server's changed.
No.
We got to shut down the old Mumble server, and the website's moving this weekend. So, you're welcome, Doc.
No, the site for the Mumble server's done. The transfer for the old thing's already done.
Remember, make JB great again, Noah, okay? That's your mission.
You know, here's my mission. Here, you're going to start a new slogan. I'm going to get you a hat and a flat brimmed hat and everything. And okay. It's going to say, screw it, we'll fix it in post. Or no. Screw it. Somebody else will fix it in post.
No, come on. You know me. I do
Rick
it live.
Yeah, the Rikai will fix it.
Out of all the people on the network, I'm the guy that least puts it on Rikai to fix it. Because, yes. You know, unless it's Comcast.
Yeah, I'm
just saying there might be other people on the network that are worse about it.
Welcome to BSD Unplugged.
I won't call out names, but there may be people on the network.
This is BSD Unplugged.
They expect a lot done in post, and it's not me.
Those BSD guys don't know how to make anything work.
What? How did you know it was them? I didn't say anything. What? What? All right, we got to get out of here. Thanks, you guys. I got to go. Thank you
Chris,
very much.
Have a wonderful vacation.
I will.
Go enjoy yourself and relax.
I will. Thank you.
The network will be fine.
Yeah. Wait. Now I thought it was until you said that. No, now I'm worried.
Get out of here. Get out of here.
Okay. Bye, guys. Bye. Bye, Noah. Thank you. You're a darling. Bye-bye now. You're the best assist. Enjoy the rest of your craziness. Thank you for making it, Noah. Hugs and kisses.
Yeah. Hugs and kisses. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.